Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Katya Adler from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the US election and the huge sums of money, billions of dollars being spent by Republicans and Democrats hoping to win in November. Who's donating the cash? And what impact does it all have on American democracy? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, from Nigeria, allegations of online hate leads to charges against a woman in Canada. What does it tell us about the state of Nigerian unity?
It shows how divided we are as a people. I think the only time Nigerians do come together to celebrate their identity is when we are playing football, you know, at the international level, and we appear to be winning. Not minding who is the goalkeeper, whether the goalkeeper is from an Igbo person, a Hausa person, or a Yoruba person.
And the Paris Paralympics are over. Who were the standout African stars?
You look at the legends of the Paralympics, and Rara Tahlili from Tunisia is right at the top of the list. She's competes in the F41 class, that's for athletes of short stature, and she won gold in both the shot put and the discus. And that is her fifth shot put title in a row. Rara Tahlili is really the symbol of Tunisian Paralympic sport, and in many ways, African Paralympic sport as well.
It's Monday, the 9th of September. First, we go to Algeria. There were elections on Saturday in Algeria, and today, results already. The winner is incumbent President Abdelmadjid Tebboune. He didn't just win, he won almost all of the votes, like up to 95% of them. No wonder his rivals are complaining. We'll see what happens next with that. But Sally Nabil, who is usually in Cairo for the BBC, was in Algiers to report on these elections. A bit of background. Algeria is a former French colony which won its independence after a very long and bitter war, the consequences of which are still felt today. It is also an oil and gas-rich powerhouse with diplomatic heft on the continent. In the early 1990s, an Islamist party started winning elections. The army stepped in and cancelled them, resulting in a civil war that only ended in 2002. Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who became president in 1999, is credited with ending what Algerians call the Black Decade. In 2019, Mr. Bouteflika was deposed in a wave of protests over political repression and economic hardship suffered by the people. He died in 2021. Mr. Tebboune became president, and from the results, he is set to remain in that position for the next 5 years. So did the results come as a surprise? Sally Nabil says no.
Even before the vote started, everybody or most of the people here knew that Mr. Tebboune, the current president, is going to easily secure a second term and is going to stay in power for another 5 years. So when the election authority announced the results and said that Mr. Tebboune got more than 94% of the vote, that came as no surprise to anybody. This partly explains why we haven't seen many voters inside the polling stations. I mean, it has been the quietest election I've ever covered. There were far more security personnel outside than people casting their votes inside.
So who did turn out to vote? We're particularly interested in how young people reacted to the election.
Young people are pretty disappointed in this country. I mean, I talked to them right after the announcement of the results. I asked a few of them, did you vote? And all of them said, no, we didn't. And no one in our family or friends did vote because we know that it's not going to change anything. We know the coming 5 years will be no different from the past 5 years. There are a few people who said, though, that Mr. Taboon, or the current president, is kind of the best choice they have at the moment, because all the other options are not pretty promising. But what we've seen inside the polling station kind of goes in the same line of thought with that, because I haven't seen many young people at all. So it has been pretty quiet, and this quietness tells a lot.
Is it worth asking whether the elections took place in an atmosphere, an attitude of free and fair in the run-up, you know, and even the circumstances under which other parties were able to campaign? Is it worth asking that, given that there's a 94% result for the incumbent?
I think the whole scene that preceded the elections kind of paved the way for this percentage, because originally there were 16 people aiming to run for presidency. The election authority excluded or disqualified most of them. So we ended up having Mr. Abdelmajid Taboon, the current president, who is competing against a socialist, who is Mr. Yusuf Aushish, and an Islamist, who is Mr. Abdelali Hassani. But out of those people who have been disqualified by the election authority, I talked to one of them, and she said that this is a political exclusion. It's not about the law. It's not about the technicalities of the election. This is more or less kind of making the race like an empty space for Mr. Taboon to win, or turning the election into a one-horse race. Because the election authority said, we disqualified these candidates because they didn't file all the documents required by the law. But again, the lady I spoke to, whose name is Zubeda Asul, she's a lawyer and party leader, she said that this election was meant to hand a very easy win to Mr. Taboon.
The general election is about restrictions on freedoms and tightly controlling to give no room to the opposition. We are not allowed to speak in public to explain to voters our plans. All these factors were not encouraging. I think the current authority doesn't want a real competitive election that can bring solid change.
And that was Zubeda Asul. So you spoke to people who were at the heart of a popular uprising that led to the downfall of Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who'd been in power for a very long time. What did they say to you?
Let me take you back to 2019 first, because I was there right after Mr. Bouteflika stepped down. And I've seen the euphoria and the optimism that marked the scene here in the heart of downtown Algiers. I could see people full of hope, having big dreams of starting a new chapter based on democracy and freedom and transparency. And they were very, very hopeful at the time. I remember that very well. Now, 5 years on, I speak to some of the people who took part in the Hirak or the uprising. And one of them tells me that I'm always thinking about leaving the country. Another one tells me, how can you have free and fair elections when journalists and protesters and human rights activists can go to jail over a Facebook post? So if you put these two pictures side by side, you can tell how much of a difference has happened over the past 5 years.
I am not convinced with the elections. Results have been decided in advance. There was no competition. We knew a second term for the president was guaranteed.
I dream of leaving the country. I have nothing to look forward to here. I just want to leave. Nothing can make me change my mind.
Mr. Taboon is the safe choice. He continues with the same old path and programs. This approach has its pros and cons. To effect a change here, it will take 20 to 30 years.
And those are voices from Algeria. Sally, what impact might these results have on Algeria's role in North African politics and its relations with neighboring countries?
I mean, the relationship with Morocco has always been tense over Western Sahara. I'm not really sure this is going to change in the next 5 years, because the Western Sahara for Algerians and for Moroccans as well, to be honest, is a very important cause. So I think those in charge, they have to address their local problems as well. It might be more of a priority now for them because of the level of discontent I've seen in the street. It's not just discontent, it's more or less indifference, because I haven't seen many posters and banners, for example, around the Algerian capital in any Arab city that is getting prepared for presidential elections. You'd see posters and banners all over the city, around every corner and every street. But that was not the case here. People were not really interested. They like the official stance of the government when it comes to the Western Sahara and how it has been supporting the Western Saharans. When it comes to local issues, they are very discontent. And at the time Algeria has to address some issues abroad, I think it might be more of a priority to fix the problems inside at the moment.
So what would the next 5 years look like for Mr. Tebboune and for Algerians? What does he need to do immediately? And will he?
He promised to create more jobs. He promised to work on sustainable economic development, especially in remote areas. A lot of young men and women here have no jobs. Unemployment rates are high. People are complaining about inflation rates. They struggle to make ends meet. So I believe economic development will be a big challenge for him, because if that discontent is to continue, it will be pretty serious, because already a lot of Algerian young men are jumping into dinghies and taking the risky trip via the Mediterranean to hit European shores, hoping for a better life. So if the economy is not to be changed for the better, these risky trips will keep going from Algeria to Europe, which is a very, very serious matter that needs to be addressed.
What strikes you about the country?
It's a beautiful country. Algiers is one of the most beautiful Arab cities that I've seen. It has an amazing coast via the Mediterranean. It has brilliant European architecture, especially in downtown. It has a lot to it than oil and gas, and it should be having more resources to bring in more money to the government and to the people. But this is not the case, unfortunately. Tourism here is very limited. The country is heavily dependent on its fuel resources, which shouldn't be the case. It has a lovely coast, which means they might look into their marine wealth as well. But the way that governments or successive governments have been handling the economy, it says a lot about their view of their country. They are not putting really a broader vision to diversify their sources of income. And this is what Mr. Tebboune and his officials have been promising, to look into other resources. But nobody here is sure that this will be the case.
The BBC's Salina Bill in Algiers.
She should be held accountable for threatening harm and death.
This Amaka patient Sanabaga's case should be an eye-opener to all. To stop the hate speech, the country should unite and focus on its common enemy, which is bad governance.
These are some of the comments we read from Nigerians on X Twitter. It's an interesting case involving a Canada-based Nigerian woman being charged with inciting violence against other Nigerians. The case has revealed divisions between Nigerians going back decades. It has also revealed the power of social media platforms to disseminate and sometimes inflame situations. I've been discussing all of this with Cletus Ukpong, who's one of the managers and head of operations for Premium Times, a newspaper in Akwa Ibom State in Nigeria's southeast. Cletus began our conversation by giving me more details about the events that led to Amaka Sonberger being charged in a court in Canada.
Quite recently, there was this video that went viral. You could hear a voice. I didn't know her. Most people didn't know who owns that voice, until a federal official came up and said, look, this is the person who owns this voice. She published her photograph on Twitter. So being that a federal official had come up to identify this person, it cleared any doubt if the video clip was fake. In that video, apparently they were having a virtual meeting on TikTok.
And what was the context within which she was making this statement?
She said, look, enough of all this hate against the Igbos. Apparently, she was responding to some other messages online which probably were targeting the Igbos, you know, where she comes from. I don't know what remark she was referring to.
So there she was, making these statements, inciting violence against specific groups of Nigerians. And she's identifying herself or talking about herself, perhaps in the context of being Igbo. So which official from which country? Was it Nigeria that identified her, said it was her?
You know, this Nigerians in Diaspora Commission. I mean, it's a commission that handles affairs of Nigerians in the diaspora. Abike Dabiri, a lady. So she came up on Twitter and identified this woman. In fact, she also gave out an information that some Nigerians in Canada were reporting her to the authorities.
To the authorities in Canada?
In Canada, yes, that's right. That's when the media houses in Nigeria picked up the story from there.
So how did Nigerians react to this?
The federal official, Abike Dabiri, you know, she posted a photograph of this woman and also said, look, this is our name. But there were other Nigerians, you know, particularly those from the Southeast, who came out and said, look, you refuse to see other remarks that were made against the Igbos. So they were attacking her and said, you are doing this because this person is an Igbo person. But when other people, the Yorubas or people who are based in Lagos, were making anti-Igbo remarks, you didn't see all those things. You know, some of them were pointing to tweets where people allegedly made some anti-Igbo remarks. But of course, she defended herself. She said, look, I don't know what's going on here, but because this is in the diaspora, so I have to come in.
So tell me this.
Yeah.
Was this the first time that the commissioner on the Diaspora Commission had actually outed somebody in this way for making remarks like this? Or is this the first time that it's happened? Is this the first time that such remarks were actually made?
She's been quite active about issues affecting Nigerians in the diaspora.
Has she called out people before?
I'm not certain about this. As far as I know, I've not seen her done this before. And we've not seen this magnitude of this kind of speech. We have not heard this magnitude of remark before.
Give us a background to the tensions that this incident highlights between different communities in Nigeria. Specifically, I suppose, in this case, Igbo, Yoruba, and people from Beninese extraction.
Nigeria has been one unfortunate country because of the leaders here. We've not really had it good at all, I must say this, because of the suffering amongst Nigerians. So people generally, there is that despondency, that feeling of, look, who should we hold for whatever has befallen us? So and you see this attack, ethnic distrust and attack on people, especially on Twitter, you know, social media. Now, I think the Igbos generally have not been treated fairly well. They have this sense of, look, we have been highly marginalized. We've not been reintegrated into the Nigerian system after the civil war. And they may be right in a way because, you know, though they are not the only people who are, you know, affected by the poor governance in the country.
Let's just take a step back into Nigeria's recent history at this point. The country became independent from Britain in 1960, and the decade that followed was a turbulent one. There was a coup and a civil war known as the Biafran War. It began in 1967 and ended in 1970. In that time, deep divisions were sown between the Igbo ethnic group, which wanted to establish a breakaway state called Biafra. The federal government, which was accused of furthering the interests of the northern Hausa Fulani and western Yoruba groups, went to war. These tensions stemmed from colonial legacies, political power struggles, and regional inequalities. And they continue today. Back to Cletus.
You wouldn't be surprised because that is what is expected in any decent society. I mean, it's better for her to appear in court, defend ourselves. Ultimately, I think Nigerians really trust the justice system in Canada. So they believe that if she has done anything wrong, she'll go in for it. But if she hasn't, she'll be free. I mean, if it were to be Nigeria, there would have been accusation of manipulation. Hey, someone manipulated the police to arrest her, even if it were not to be true.
What impact do you think this has on Nigeria's sense of itself and Nigerians in their identity as Nigerians?
It shows how divided we are as a people. So unfortunate. It's a call for action, not just on the part of government, but the media as well. Let us report things that will promote our unity. And then let us, as a people, campaign for good governance. I mean, if Nigeria were to be okay, you wouldn't be having all these ethnic disunity. It raises a fundamental question about the Nigerian identity. So you see someone outside telling people, look, I'm a Yoruba, I'm an Igbo, I'm an outside person. Not necessarily a Nigerian, but I think the only time Nigerians do come together to celebrate their identity is when we are playing soccer, when we are playing football, you know, at the international level, and we appear to be winning. Not minding who is the goalkeeper, whether the goalkeeper is from an Igbo person, a Hausa person, or a Yoruba person.
In some communities, the words that people use against others are often seen as justification to visit violence on those people. And you see, it's not, you know, words have consequences and they can hurt. So I was just wondering whether, in this case, that could be possible.
It's scary. And I don't think people will begin to attack the Yorubas.
Or like the other way around as well. I mean, you know, others attacking Igbos because they feel like they were being attacked first with these words.
The tension has already been there. So now, but there's a greater challenge, which is the economic hardship. So probably, I think that the economic situations has overwhelmed the remark that this woman made.
Thank you very much. Nigerians are not unique in this regard, but there are so many of you. So the noise on social media is very loud, isn't it, when it does happen?
Social media is a place where people go to vent their angers and all those things. But in the streets, a lot of persons may not be aware of this.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Cletus Ogbong, one of the managers and head of operations for Premium Times, a national newspaper in Nigeria. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is not who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys. Season 2, The Disciples. And Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC.
After 11 days of spectacular sport, the curtains have come down on the 2024 Paralympics in Paris. France was widely praised for how it ran both the Olympics and the Paralympics. There were 44 African countries taking part, some with just one competitor. Last time round, when the Games were held in Tokyo, Africa won a total of 63 medals. This time, the total medal haul was slightly higher, and one country, Mauritius, made history. Millions of people around the world watched, and the hope is that this success will boost opportunities and participation of people with disabilities in sport. So, how did the continent do, and who stood out? BBC Sport Africa reporter Rob Stevens was just off the train from Paris when we spoke. Hello.
Hello, Audrey.
How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Yeah, it's been a whirlwind few days.
But, right.
Yeah.
You've literally just got off the train from Paris. Where are you now?
Yes, Audrey, I'm at Euston Station, just waiting to make a connection. It really feels like the end of the Paralympics is very much there. It was quite a quiet Paris this morning when I was getting my cab ride to the Gare du Nord station. And I'm sad in a way to be returning because it's been a brilliant 11 days of competition and a great bit of time in Paris in terms of the games themselves. Paris really put on a show for both the Olympics and for the Paralympics as well. So I'm sad in a way that this kind of chapter is over.
Well, in 4 years' time, you'll be back again. Not in Paris, though, somewhere else, I've no doubt. Tell us about the achievements of the African athletes. How did they fare?
Well, they've done, probably, I'd say, a job of consolidation. They've done very well. But if you're looking at
the bare bones, the numbers themselves, in terms of numbers of medals, it was much the same from what it was in Tokyo. So in Tokyo it was 63 medals, which were evenly split, 21 gold, 21 silver, 21 bronze. This time they surpassed that, but only by a minimum standard. They got 64 medals overall. They did get more of those that were gold this time round, so that's 23 gold medals, 17 silver and 24 bronze. But I guess the challenges are still there for Africa to grow the number of participants, to grow the number of entries in the games themselves, and probably to have more entries in particular sports. I think it was three sports, three disciplines overall that didn't have any African representation in it at all, and there were only one or two competitors in other certain events. So track cycling, for example, there was only one Ghanaian, Frederick Assor. He was the only African in track cycling, whereas Philippa Johnson Dwyer, she was the only African in the para equestrian event. So Africa is very well represented in certain sports like para athletics and para powerlifting. Those are the two main ones, but through a lot of the many other sports, there aren't so many competitors from Africa.
Mr. Assor's achievement, though, in the cycling was amazing. One of the first ever, or certainly the first African that we know, that has entered the velodrome, no?
Yes, and it's just an achievement to get here in a way, because in terms of the training that he has back home in Ghana, he doesn't have access to a proper velodrome. There are only two in Africa. There's one in Egypt, and it's tough for him as well to ride with a guide cyclist, because he rides a tandem bike. So I think that's very much one of the trickier sports to grow in Africa, just because to get access to a velodrome itself is expensive, the bikes are expensive, the gear's expensive. He's very bullish. I read an interview with him where he said that if he had the same funding as they do for Team GB or perhaps the Netherlands, who are very strong in that sport, then he could compete on a more even playing field. But it's always the question of funding that is difficult.
Just give us a breakdown of the countries that were there. Is that up from Tokyo?
Well, there were 44 countries overall from Africa that were there. I don't have the precise figures from Tokyo because there's a lot of data to go through, but 44 countries from Africa were there at the Games. Nine of them were only sending one representative. So that's the slight problem in terms of the number of entries, the number of competitors that are there. Several others had two. So quite a lot of African countries who were there sent rather small teams. Egypt and Morocco had the biggest contingents. That was boosted by their participation in team sports as well. The North African countries and South Africa, who really had the largest number of teams there.
And the medal count, did it reflect the countries that had the bigger teams? Did they also get the more medals?
The medal count was very much as it was in terms of Tokyo, in terms of the usual suspects. So Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, they were towards the top of the table. Morocco got the most medals. They got 15 overall. Algeria got the most gold, 6 overall. And then if you're looking a bit further down the table, Nigeria, Egypt, Ethiopia and South Africa all picked up 2 gold medals each. And then Namibia, Kenya and Mauritius were the other 3 countries from Africa that got on the medal table. I must mention Mauritius because they created history. That was their first Paralympic medal. It was Yevani Philippe in one of the sprint races, 400 metres in his discipline. So that's a piece of history there, because 26 African countries went to these Paralympics without a medal, and Mauritius were the only one to make that piece of history.
Any standout African athletes for you?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the legends of the Paralympics, and Rara Talili from Tunisia is right at the top of the list. She's competes in the F41 class, that's for athletes of short stature, and she won gold in both the shot put and the discus, and that is her 5th shot put title in a row. So going all the way back to Beijing 2008, when she was 18 years old, she is undefeated since then at the Paralympics. And in terms of the discus, it was her 3rd in a row, and she won 2 silver before that. So she has 8 Paralympic gold medals, that's a national record for Tunisia, and 10 Paralympic medals overall. There are plenty of names to pick out, but Rara Talili is really the symbol of Tunisian Paralympic sport, and in many ways African Paralympic sport as well.
What stood out for you? Which particular competition did you enjoy most, do you think?
The great thing was about Paris was the way that they sold the city. So the two that will stay with me forever would be watching the blind football in front of the Eiffel Tower, which was an absolutely stunning backdrop, and
the nuance of the sport is that you must be absolutely quiet during the game, but at times there were points the fans couldn't contain their excitement in terms of when there was a save made or when the post was hit or when a goal was scored, and where they erupted and it kind of disrupted the players slightly, but the crowd were most on well behaved. But the setting of that itself was incredible, and the skill on show from the blind footballers who all have visual impairments, the goalkeepers can see and there are guides behind the goals. It's really an incredible and intense sport to watch. The other one for me was the para archery, which took place in front of the Hotel des Invalides, which is the final resting place of Napoleon. Great history, great place to watch sport. The para archery was incredible there. And final one I must mention as well, the Grand Palais, to watch para taekwondo and wheelchair fencing. Again, an incredible arena and kind of a once-in-a-lifetime experience to watch high-level sport in those areas.
So what would you say is the prognosis for sport for people with disabilities in Africa?
The first edition of the African Para Games was held last year in Ghana. It had three sports. The idea is now to grow that event continentally in terms of adding more sports to it, and particularly ones that are included in the Paralympic Games. So last time round, there was amputee football, which is not a Paralympic sport. There was wheelchair basketball, which is a Paralympic sport, but which Africa did not have any participants in. And there was wheelchair tennis. So basically, the African Para Games needs to grow to have more sports included in it. So perhaps para powerlifting, perhaps boccia, a few other sports that Africa can get into, and then use that to qualify more competitors for the Paralympic Games in future. The African Paralympic Committee is launching new schemes to try and increase the profile of disability sport as well, in terms of getting more funding, getting more sponsors on board. They believe that the talent pool is there, so it's drawing on that talent pool as well, and getting them more involved in the sport and basically increasing the level of competition on the continent.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye. Go home and get some rest, right. I think. You've been up early.
Thanks very much.
Okay, bye.
Cheers. Take care.
That's BBC Sport Africa reporter Rob Stevens. Focus on Africa was put together by Bella Hassan, Stefania Okereke, Kane Peary, and Patricia Whitehorn. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist in charge. Francesca Dunn and Jack Raismark were our technical producers. Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
Up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is not who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys. Season 2, The Disciples. And Season 3, The Apartheid Killer, are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC.